The other day, I stumbled upon a video which seemed pretty usual for my feed, but after watching it a couple of times, it suddenly revealed to me what I think is the most pressing problem the left faces right now, and I had to make a video about it. So here's the real video that I saw. Actually, I'm not gonna show you the whole thing right now. We'll go step by step, keep a little bit of suspense. The creator is Jessica Burbank, interviewing Democrats at the Crooked Con, a political conference run by Crooked Media, the company behind political podcasts like Pod Save America. I'm interested in just the first 10 seconds of this clip with Jen Costin, who can be described as progressive libertarian. She wants to limit government power and is concerned about social justice and civil rights. The first thing we notice in this video is the text at the top, asking people at Crooked Con the big question. The big question is,
what can the Democratic Party can do to win back regular working people?
Two things here, the Dems, Democrats, and you know what, for the sake of the analysis, we'll expand that to the left, whether it's in the US, the UK, Europe, etc. Then we have win back. That implies there was a loss. Here we're referring to voters who have moved from left to right in recent decades. This has been a big narrative circulating in the media, you know, the idea that the left is losing regular working people. That big take is a bit more nuanced than it seems. The shift is slow, many working class groups continue to vote in majority for the left, and a lot of working class people simply don't vote. But it is true that the left is losing working class support over time. As Jessica mentions, this is the big question. It became an even bigger question after the election of Zoran Mamdani, who showed that a working class-centered agenda could be an answer to the difficulties many left-wing parties face. Zoran talked about rent freezes, free buses, universal childcare. Those things speak to everyone. So when Jessica asks this question to Jane, it almost sounds like a gotcha, because the answer is obvious. Zoran just proved it. But a lot of Democrats don't want to hear it. Now, before we actually hear Jane Costin's answer, I want to draw your attention to the choice of word here. Regular working people.
What can the Democratic Party can do to win back regular working people?
I've seen this expression being used alternatively with working class people, and I'm always curious to know what the people saying it actually mean. And before I do that, I want to clarify where I'm speaking from. I'm speaking from the perspective of someone who has grown up in a rural area around mostly working class and low middle class individuals who vote in majority for the far right. We were, for a lot of us, the first generation to go to university. I know a lot of people assume that I have rich parents because I speak more than one languages or all the things. I don't. My mother was a nurse. My dad was an employee in a local manufacturing business. They divorced when I was 8. Very taboo in the area. They don't really speak English, but they're both curious and informed individuals. I was on scholarship during my studies, which were done at a public university in the north of France. Higher education was mostly free for me, and I worked part-time as a tennis instructor. I've always been a really good student, excellent marks in every single subject, from English to math, from French to sports. I'm very efficient at learning. I love learning. I'm curious about literally anything. I don't like to talk about myself. Girls don't like to brag. And I don't want you to believe I'm some sort of exceptional individual, because I'm not. I believe that talent is a myth, even though my past is quite unusual. There were some external factors I had no power over, which led me to be where I am today. In fact, my story is an example that some assumptions we make about people aren't always right. And that's why I want to ask you, what sort of assumptions do you make when you hear the phrase regular working person? Like, when I say regular working person, sometimes switched for working class, what do you imagine? What job, what look, what accent, what skin color? I'm interested in the expression regular working people because it has often been used by right-wing parties.
Good evening, my fellow Americans.
Standing for the so-called silent majority, as Republican President Richard Nixon put it. You know, the people who go to work, who raise families, and don't ask much from the government. Republicans have used that as a dog whistle for white Republican families for decades. But in recent years, the left, in an attempt to distance itself from social Democrats, has started using that phrase too.
What can the Democratic Party can do to win back regular working people?
While conservatives' dog whistle to white voters is pretty obvious, progressives' use of the phrase regular working people or the working class is less clear. Who are they actually talking about? What does that mean to them? So I did my research, I watched and read a lot of interviews of progressives, articles, speeches, and realized that no one knows what working class means anymore. Back in the days, things were so simple. You had the owning class and the working class. But today, things don't seem as sharply defined as they used to. And this isn't just unfortunate, it's also worrying. The fact that something so significant to the identity of the left loses its meaning is concerning. If we say that working classes need to be put at the center of left-wing political movements, we should at least agree on what we mean by it. Now, this is precisely what this video is about. We're gonna have three parts in this one. First, class as culture. Second, class as practice. And finally, what class means in the 21st century. My name's Alice. Welcome back to my channel. Today, I'm gonna talk about the working class. Part 1. Class is a culture. Okay, guys, I just need to tell you about our sponsor today. We all know that social media apps collect our data to then sell it to anyone who wants it. Like you and I could go to any data broker right now and pay just a few bucks for someone else's personal information. And the funny thing is, this is completely legal. Big companies with weak security systems get hacked all the time, which means that your personal information is being sold on the dark web so that spammers, scammers, and identity thieves can target you. And they face zero repercussions. Governments are super slow at tackling those issues, and the risk of having personal information leaked is very high. So you want to make sure you're doing the right thing to protect yourself. That's why I use Aura, the sponsor of today's video. Aura keeps me safe by doing all the hard work for me. They will identify data brokers who are selling my information and submit opt-out requests on my behalf. You can honestly see results in just a few weeks. Less spams, less dodgy emails. Aura also lets me know if anyone is using my personal information to access credit or bank accounts. And in the worst case scenario, they can give me up to $5 million in identity theft insurance. Finally, and you won't believe it, the Aura app also has a VPN with 100 plus virtual locations. I know, it's all happening in one app, so if you want to try it out, you can go to my link, aura.com/AliceCapel, to try 14 days for free. I repeat, it's aura.com/AliceCapel, CAPELLE. And yeah, let's go back to the video. Before we go back to the real, we need to establish some foundations. So let's start with a pragmatic example that we'll reuse throughout the video. Imagine we have, on the one hand, the son of a factory worker who, after a few years working as a plumber, starts a plumbing business. The business is doing well, and he reaches a point where he can hire interns and then proper employees who are paid by his company. That's plumber boss number one. Let's call him Danny. Now, a different situation. This time, a freshly trained plumber inherits the plumbing company from his father and now has people working for him. This is plumber boss number two. Let's call him Rory. These two stories start very differently. One person comes from a working class background, the other was already middle or even upper class. But these stories end the same way. Danny and Rory are the bosses and they have people working for them. So my question to you is very simple. Would you say these people are of different social classes? Now, if you view class as a culture, an identity, you'll probably answer yes. Plumber boss number one, Danny, carries with him his working class identity despite the fact that he's a business owner. In that sense, class isn't just about money, it's also about how people live. What feels normal, what feels embarrassing, what hobbies they pick up, even how they speak. From that angle, you can see why someone like David Beckham, even with all his money, is still viewed by a lot of people as sort of working class. The idea of class as more than just an economic or work status was influenced by sociologist Pierre Bourdieu, who came up with the idea of the habitus. The habitus? French people get angry at me when I say habitus. But anyway, the habitus connects the job a person does to certain tastes, styles, and activities. Vice versa, certain activities, tastes, and styles can be associated with a specific social class. So if you tell me a person is a soccer player, a fan of Drake, and smokes single-use vapes, my assumption is that he would be a young, working-class, low-middle-class man. Now, if you tell me golf player, Ralph Lauren jumper, lives in Hampstead Heath, I would probably say upper-class, middle-aged man. That's kind of what we mean by habitus. Now, if you've been following me for a while, you know that I'm really interested in Bourdieu's work. Bourdieu is one of those thinkers whose ideas have really penetrated culture. We recognize the influence of the habitus in things like starter packs, for example, the tech bro, the hipster, the attractive old guy. Apparently, that's a thing. We have a natural inclination towards putting people in boxes and making assumptions about them. And let's be honest, Bourdieu's concept of the habitus is just perfect for that. Stop calling yourself a people watcher. You are a sociologist. So yeah, all those elements, taste, lurks, hobbies, can help us figure out one's social class. Actually, that's why when Victoria Beckham explained to us in that Netflix docuseries that she comes from a working class background, David didn't intervene to ask her what job her parents were doing. No, he asks what car did her dad drive.
We're very working class.
Be honest.
I am being honest.
How did your dad drive you to school in?
My dad.
What car was it?
All right, it's not a simple answer
what
because.
What car did you get your dad to drive?
It depends.
No.
Okay, what in car? The '80s, my dad had a Rolls Royce.
Thank you.
You'd think, what's the point of asking this? She's talking about a social class or her parents' economic status. What does a car have to do with it? Well, the car can be a signifier of one's social class. You can't be working class and drive a Rolls Royce. That's why Victoria didn't want to answer that question. She knew the implication of her answer. So actually, none of our characters so far are working class. David, Danny, Victoria, Rory. However, some characters are seen as more legitimate to reclaim that working class identity because they carry it with them in the form of taste, possessions, memories, so a bunch of cultural artifacts that are characteristic of a working class existence. Now, the lesson we can learn for this video is that when we say working class, we have to agree what we mean by it. Are we talking about working class, the culture, taste, lyrics, etc.? Are we talking about working class as an economic status? Or are we talking about both? As we've just seen with our examples, working class culture can be separated from its related economic status. That's why you can see rich kids in trendy neighborhoods dressed with vintage Carhartt, distressed jeans, and football scarves. And that's why, on the other hand, some working class kids, aware of the negative perception of their class, adopt the aesthetic of old money in the hope of facilitating upward social mobility. When Bourdieu's concept of the habitus gets detached from its economic component, it becomes just a culture, an aesthetic, ready to be appropriated. The examples I've given aren't really harmful. I guess we should let them bourgeois kids enjoy for a few years the sort of cheap beers that give working class people cancer. But when you scale this appropriation of the working class aesthetic, when you use it for political purposes, for example, that's where things get tricky. Let's move on to part two. Class is a culture. No. Class is a practice. So culture and identity are often seen as stable and fixed, things that make up who a person is. Practice, on the other hand, is much more fluid, you see? It suggests that we are social beings shaped by external forces and in turn shaping others through our daily actions and routines. Let's go back to our example to see what I mean. If we view class as a practice, something shaped by daily roles, routines, and the power we hold or are subjected to, then plumber boss Danny, who grew up working class, and plumber boss Rory, who inherited the business, are much more alike than they first appear. They are both bosses. They assign tasks, they manage employees, and sign paychecks at the end of the month. In practice, they occupy the same position, and that position shapes them as individuals and ultimately determines their social class. This is also why we often say that billionaires live in a completely different reality. Their wealth reshapes how they move through the world, to the point where they cannot genuinely relate to the experience of a regular working person. Danny may not be Elon Musk, but his status as an employer still influences how he sees the world, how he lives on a daily basis, and even how he votes. We're almost circling back to the original reel now, but there is still a little bit more groundwork to do. I am, like Danny, a boss. I have a business, and I'd be lying to you if I said I'm immune to the social forces I've just described. I'm very aware of this. I also make sure that I have a job outside of YouTube, with a more traditional work settings, with hierarchies and colleagues and unions, precisely to resist those forces that are shaping me, whether I want it or not. Again, like if I spend a section of my week telling other people what to do and send them a paycheck at the end of the month, that has an impact on me, how I view myself on the social hierarchy. Small business owners are actually a super interesting case study. They employ a big chunk of the working population, 46% of all American workers, for example. And because they are small business owners, they tend to be viewed as regular working people. Contrary to big bosses, they tend to live closer to their workers and engage with them more. French sociologist Benoît Coquart explains that workers often look up to their hardworking, made-it image. Because these figures are visible and respected, their views, political ones included, can carry real weight. People may end up aligning their votes with these local bosses, whether out of admiration, a wish to fit in, or simply because their choices feel like the community norm. I really want to state this and hammer this. We can have sympathy for small business owners, but it's important to remember that, especially in rural and suburban area, those small business owners have a huge impact on how people vote, and they tend to vote for center-right to right-wing parties. So yeah, we should support them for sure, like they're a big part of the economy and everything, but at the same time, we have to understand that these people, from a left-wing perspective, are not our allies. Okay, we're making progress. So you see in the first part on class as culture, we established that someone like plumber bomber plumber boss Danny may be associated with the working class because he has kept the aesthetic, the culture, the language of working class people. But, as we saw in the second part, as soon as we switch to a view of class focused on practice, then we understand that Danny's economic status and daily practices put him in the category of the owning class. So not so regular anymore. Okay, guys, I think this is it. It's finally time to check Jen Costin's answer, the moment you've all been waiting for.
What can the Democratic Party can do to win back regular working people?
Well, I think that one of the funny things when we talk about the working class, a lot of times what I think a lot of people mean is they mean white people, because African-American women are like the backbone of the Democratic Party, and African-American women are also more likely to be working class if we're depending on working class as a class definition, not as a cultural definition. When we talk about working class, sometimes we think we mean a vibe, but a lot of times those vibes are like truck or has this type of job. But I'm like, you still make $300,000 a year. I don't know if it still counts.
See, that's exactly what we just talked about. A farmer making $300,000 a year is clearly not a regular working person. This is not to say that all farmers make this amount of money, that is not true, but keep in mind that as more farmers get their land bought up by bigger players, we have to remain skeptical of what type of farmer we're actually talking about, of what definition of working class we choose. It's not because they have a truck and a rural accent and no college education that they are regular working people, or even working class. Some of those big players are besties with agribusiness and will do anything they can to ruin the land and the lives of small working class farmers. So I think you start to see now how convenient it can be for people like Danny or for that 300k salary farmer to be perceived as regular working people. It acts like a camouflage, allowing them to voice their own political interest as members of the asset class, the owning class. So interests that have little to do with the actual working class. In fact, data shows that while low education voters mostly voted for Trump, this trend is particularly true for low education voters with high income. So that's the 300k salary farmer, that's potentially Danny. On the contrary, low education voters with low income still lean Democrat. As always, those analyses are always very contextual. I'm sure some of you will come up saying, no, that's not true, whatever. But you know, they relate to what we've been saying in the second part. And now part three, what class means in the 21st century. It's interesting to me that as soon as Jessica said regular working people, Jen suspected that she used it like the usual right-wing dog whistle, therefore implying right rural and suburban men. The combination of winning back plus regular working people materialized in her head as the typical Trump electorate. That's why she corrected the question by stressing that regular working people aren't necessarily the real working class. We explained it in part one and two. Class is not just a vibe, a culture, or a set of symbols like trucks and football scars. It's an economic reality. Now, I'm sure Jessica doesn't mean to use regular working people as a dog whistle for white, rural and suburban men. I'm sure she also refers to the increasing Black and Latino population and even women leaving left-wing parties to turn right or even far right. But you see, that doesn't really come across in the phrase regular working people. Jen's assumption that she refers to white, rural and suburban men makes sense in a way, because for most of history, that's what regular working people meant. Women, Black people, queer people, disabled people, they weren't part of the regular working people category. In the same manner that when you say doctor or scientist, people tend to picture a man. When you say regular working people, people tend to picture white, rural and suburban men. And we see this bias even in left-wing circles, because the progressives who say they want to appeal to the regular working class start adopting the culture, language and style of white, rural and suburban men. As someone commented on a live stream of a small streamer you probably haven't heard of, quote, part of the issue of insisting that leftists engage in working class aesthetics is that people can almost see it as disingenuous. People aren't stupid, and wearing a cowboy hat and flannel is not going to actually convince people to join the cause. And this has been proven time and time again. It also begs the question, what do working class aesthetic even entail? Now, the more I think about it, the more I'm convinced that if someone like Zohra Mamdani or Bernie Sanders had asked Jane the exact same question, her reaction would have been completely different. I don't think she would have heard it as a dog whistle coming from them. And that difference is probably the key to how the left, the real left, can actually win in the 21st century. Whenever Bernie or Zoran talk about regular working people, because they do, I don't picture the stereotypical Trump voter. They've somehow taken a phrase that has long functioned as a right-wing dog whistle and transformed it into something genuinely universal, something that speaks to all segments of the working class. How did they do that? Well, take a look at Zoran Mamdani's platform. Affordability is central, but look at this. Childcare, LGBTQ plus rights, climate, libraries, community safety to replace overpolicing. And look also at 2015, in the run-up to the 2016's Democratic primary. After Black Lives Matter activists interrupted several Bernie Sanders events, the candidate for the primary significantly expanded his platform on racial justice, adding proposals on police reform, mass incarceration, and systemic racism. You see, people like Bernie Sanders or Zoran Mamdani aren't just using the phrase regular working people or working class. They are also reshaping what it means in the 21st century. They don't rely on an outdated post-war definition which excluded entire groups of people, blacks, women, queers, disabled, despite their overrepresentation in precarious jobs. That old-school definition also doesn't take into account how tech empires have remodeled the economy with micro-tasks and pseudo-entrepreneurship. Left-wing movements of the 21st century have to reinvent the working class by telling those who've been historically excluded and those who, given their level of education or the industry they work in, don't think they could be part of it, that this is for them too. This is what working class means. This is how the left wins. I'm not saying Zoran or Bernie are perfect, they're not, but they've identified the problem and they're actually doing something about it. And you know what? They're not alone. Across the UK, the US, France, and much of Europe, new left movements are redefining what working class means and who gets included in the regular working people definition. They're updating the vocabulary, rebuilding the foundations, and unlocking levels of engagement we thought were gone for good. It is genuinely exciting. If you enjoyed this video, you're probably going to enjoy my essay that I wrote for the last issue of the Stingfly magazine. It's the winter 2025 issue. The essay that I wrote is titled The Dark Mountains Bloom, and it's all about the former mining basin in the north of France where the coal mining industry used to be super big, super powerful. The coal mines closed in the 1990s. I talk about the collective memory of the mining basin, but also I kind of look at the history of, you know, that era, the coal mining era, as honestly as possible, looking at the surveillance system that was put in place in the north of France. Kind of insane surveillance systems, to be honest. I actually grew up in the north of France. My mom grew up in the mining basin. She used to play on what she called the Dark Mountains, which are pretty much like Terril, they are pretty much big coal slag heaps. Yeah, so it's a mix of personal essay, historical essay, journalistic reporting. There's a little bit of everything. That's what we call creative nonfiction. So yeah, if you enjoyed this video, I'm pretty sure you're gonna like this. Similar themes, similar questions. You can get your copy on the website of The Stinging Fly. I'll put a link in the description box, and please tell me what you think about it. That's it. That's all I had to say on this topic for today. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, then please leave me a little like. Subscribe if it's not already done. You can also support me on Patreon. We have released a lot of exclusive content lately. My 5-year channel anniversary video. It's been 5 years. The monthly favorites, that's a recurring thing. Let's go with the monthly favorites. We also have a Discord chat. If you want to join us, I'll put a link in the description down below. This leads me to say a big thank you to my Patreons and a special thank to top tier Patreons. Alex Harbin, Alina Kalitova, Boris Brandon, Christopher France, Corey G, Donage, Fred, Hong Ching Wan, Ian, Jem Siddle, Jeff Lee, Manuel, Nofal Jamari, Nick, Pablo, Patrick, Patrick Riley, Paul-Louis Agenot, Perry, Ria, Taya Matin, Tristan, Ujwal, and Yelan. That's it for me. Thank you so much for watching again, and I'll see you very soon. Salut! All good, all good, all good.